You're listening to the Art of Move podcast, hosted by Dr. William Raybar and Anthony Manuel, where we attempt to create a grand unified theory of human movement, biomechanics, and training. If you enjoy these episodes, you can watch them streamed live on nofilter.net, where you can interact directly and have all your questions answered in real time.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 100 of the Art of Move podcast with myself, Anthony Manuel, my great friend, Dr. William Raybar. We are still out here in the Canadian Rockies trying to find the grand unified theory of human movement, biomechanics, and what it means to live and exist in the human body. Our guest today is the most anticipated of any on the show. He needs no introduction from any of you in the audience. We have the privilege of talking to none other than Tom Myers. You may know him as a pioneer who catalyzed a change in perspective that made the entire functional fitness space possible. His contributions to the field of understanding the human body can't be understated. In fact, it's not a reach to say that if there were no Tom Myers, there would be no Art of Move podcast either. For those who are unfamiliar with Tom and his work, he has a robust resume as the originator of anatomy trains, having studied with Drs. Ida Rolf, Moshe Feldenkrais, Buckminster Fuller, and with a variety of movement and manual therapy pioneers. An inveterate traveler, Tom has practiced integrative manual therapies for over 40 years in a variety of clinical and cultural settings, influenced by cranial, visceral, and intrinsic movement studies he made with European schools of osteopathy. Very well known for being the author of Anatomy Trains, as well as a myriad of other books on manual therapy and anatomy. He has also produced over 20 online learning courses with Anatomy Trains and others in collaboration with various body-oriented professional groups. Now living and sailing on the coast of Maine in the USA, Tom and his faculty conduct professional development courses and certification in structural integration worldwide. And that's just a small taste of Tom's professional biography, though, for those who have been living under a rock. Today, however, we're going to be discussing a term that Tom coined, which is spatial medicine, which asks questions like, how does the body develop in utero? How does it learn competencies in 3D space, manipulate the environment, move through the environment? How do we stand in relationship to gravity, develop somatic intuition, and continue to develop and maintain our physical skills and competency as we age? So if you've been listening for a while, these are all the same questions that we've been asking over 99 episodes. Tom, first of all, thank you so much for joining us today. We're extremely, extremely excited. I'm talking for myself at this point. I'm really excited to have you on here discuss some of these topics.
Anthony, Dr. Raybar, it's great to be with both of you. And as you noted, the subject is of great interest to me. I got to get my people to update my biography. It's next year, it'll be 50 years in the trade.
Wow.
So I'm celebrating my whatever it is, golden, diamond, whatever 50 is.
Yeah, half a century, if you want to call it that. It's a pretty big run. So can we talk about this idea of spatial medicine? Because one of the things that you had mentioned is, you know, chemical and psychiatric medicine has played, you know, obviously a major part in civilization, but it also comes with its limitations. And spatial medicine is kind of up and coming as this thing that's going to be very integral and important to, I mean, maybe even just like healing the collective of humanity as a whole. And I'd love to talk about what your perceptions of some of the limitations of some of these other forms of medicine are and why spatial medicine is so important as we continue along our journey here.
Well, all the forms of medicine are very important. It's just that spatial medicine has been largely ignored for the last couple of centuries because we have been industrializing ourselves so fast and not realizing how quickly we're changing the environment around our bodies. So it's not that our bodies have changed so much as the environment that we live in. So you could say that we've constructed a zoo and we live in the zoo. We're both the zookeepers and one of the animals in the zoo. And that's not just a saying. If you look at the neural crest genes that are responsible for the changes in the face that turn a wolf into a dog or a wildcat into a domestic cat, our neural crest genes have changed as well. We have domesticated ourselves. And that's a really big problem for the body. It's a problem for bodies in zoos, right? How do you keep a tiger in a cage? Well, how do you keep a human not carousing around the top of the trees in Africa or wandering on the shores of Saudi Arabia, but actually living in an urban environment? That is the challenge that comes to us. And that's a spatial medicine challenge.
And so what are the some of the environmental factors of modern life that domesticate us? What are, like, obviously living indoors, there's a lot of talk about blue light, EMFs, you know, obviously being isolated from natural factors like having your feet on the ground and grounding, having broad exposure to natural sunlight. In your perception, what are some of the more insidious factors of modern life that are kind of domesticating us?
Well, if you follow James Nestor and the whole movement around breath, and Paul Ehrlich has written a book with somebody else called Jaws, we're really looking at the mismatch between food and our genetics. So one of the reasons that I, at 18, lost my wisdom teeth because there wasn't enough room for them in my jaw, so they were so-called impacted and had to be taken out. Well, why would God give me wisdom teeth and not enough room in my gums to get that wisdom? Yeah. But in point of fact, because I was eating bologna and French's mustard and Wonder Bread when I was a kid in the 50s, I did not get the hard food that, chewing on leather, chewing on seeds, chewing on less processed food. Almost every process you do with food makes it softer. So, nowadays they're having kids chewing on things and but that's just correcting for the fact that our food had changed. So the food changed. And then our bodies changed based on food change. So the environment has changed and our bodies have changed depending on that environment change. And that is, this is a familiar litany to all your listeners, sitting, shoes, focused 25 centimeters away on a screen. Those are probably the three major things. And then you talk about EMFs and blue light and all those other things we just don't know, because we're performing this huge experiment on humanity of industrializing it within a couple of hundred years with no controls, right? We've destroyed or completely infiltrated all the Neolithic or even agrarian societies. In this country, I can't tell about Canada, but I bet you it's about the same. But in the 1800s, 65% of the people were required to work on the farms. Now, 3% of the people are required to work on the farms, and 97% of the people are industrialized. So at least when you work on a farm, you are working all day. You are moving. You are baling hay and throwing the bales places. And in an industrial society, you start just moving parts from here to here. You become like a machine and therefore are easily replaced as a machine. And then even that's unnecessary because we are being replaced by machines. So now we're in the electronic era where boink with your finger is all that's really required to have your groceries arrive at your door. I was out in California this winter and I was living in a house that their groceries arrived at the door from Amazon Prime. Things from the drugstore arrived from Amazon Prime. It just drove me nuts. Can't you get in the car and go get something? We've come to a place in society where embodiment is not necessary, and we've never been in that place before. You don't have to have genes that say exercise. You couldn't get through a day without exercising. Now, question about what kind of exercise and all of that. There's all of those are questions, but now you can. So we have a genetic mismatch. This is why spatial medicine is coming up now, is we have a genetic mismatch between our genes that say conserve calories at all costs, because you never know when you're going to need them, and the fact that you can not work and eat all day in this time of abundance just does not work for our bodies. So we're used to, if I can go off in another direction just for a minute and I'll come back to spatial medicine, but we're very used to IQ. We test IQ. We know how to test IQ. They might have some prejudices in the tests and all of that, but we're pretty good at testing IQ. And thanks to Daniel Goleman and a bunch of women, we're learning about EQ. We're learning about emotional intelligence and that there's an intelligence in there too. It's not just all IQ. I don't know about you, but I hire for EQ. I can teach them the skills, but I can't teach them emotional intelligence as easily, so I hire for that. But we're now talking about a third thing, which is KQ, which is kinesthetic intelligence. And if I look at the kids, because I call them kids because I'm in my 70s, that I'm working with in my teachers and in my students, some of them have just not developed basic body competencies in the youth that they were provided in their public schools or their cityfied environments that they grew up in or suburban environments, that there simply wasn't the stimulus in there to stimulate KQ, which is kinesthetic intelligence. And that's what we're beginning to explore now. And we're having to explore it because it's not naturally being provided by the environment. we have to supply exercise because it's not being naturally supplied by the environment. And that's a very big change.
So the intervention you would propose here is giving exercise to the kids, or what is the intervention you would propose for the population?
Education and all this is not my expertise. So with the proviso that this is just a off the top of my head proposal, a kinesthetically aware society would start by teaching parents how their baby is going to move. So we just, you can overpower a small baby, a small body. So babies get picked up from, put from place to place, strapped into car seats, and otherwise moved around simply because they can. I was very fortunate before I had my baby, or before my wife had our baby, to come across this work, which combined Feldenkrais and Aikido and developmental movement theory into a sweet little thing that I was able to move with my baby. This is not baby massage. Baby massage is great, but this is handling skills. And I do believe that we would get out of a lot of our problems if parents, you know, who are required to take a test to drive a car down the road, we're now going to have children who are an increasingly precious resource because there's going to be fewer and fewer children in the world. So children are going to be a very precious resource, meaning we need to invest more in them. And one of the things we need to invest in them is physical health. This is no news. The poet Juvenal in 500 AD said, "Mens sana in corpore sano," which is a healthy mind and a healthy body. And the reason that they did that was they noticed that the children of the noblemen, who were in the position of everybody today, in other words, they had enough to eat and they didn't have to work, they recognized, hey, we need to have a gym for these people. They're not only corpulent, but they're corpulent in their thinking. They are not fit to be the noblemen of the next generation. And that's where the gymnasium and athletics, it started there, and it also started to keep the soldiers busy when they came home so they wouldn't rape and pillage locally. Sports was invented for that as well. But we now need to be much, much more conscious about the kinesthetic intelligence of the kids that we're graduating. I graduated from my high school knowing more about the principal exports of Chile than I did about my own body. It's not something that I was educated in at all, not by my parents. Sexuality is part of the body. Moving properly is part of the body. Knowing yourself, I think, if we gave kids a lot more knowledge of themselves kinesthetically, they would emotionally mature faster. They would be more resilient to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and they'll be more adaptable. Because I don't want to be I don't want to start in so soon being the pessimist, but we've got hard times coming at us. This is not going to be an easy time for our kids. Name whatever set of crises that are building into a meta crisis that you want to, but we need adaptable kids. We need adaptable kids to take care of us when we're old, because it's not going to be so easy as it has been in the last generation since World War II.
So one of the things that I'd like to kind of circle back on and explore a little bit is this idea of a genetic mismatch between our physical culture and what we were maybe designed to do, what environments we were exposed to, and how we were physically meant to move within our environment. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how much of that you think that original environment and those original like movement functions should inform the way that we train or the way that we should approach our physical culture. There's a lot of people who we've interviewed who take a, hey, let's look at indigenous tribes. Let's look at how human beings would have moved in relation to evolutionary biomechanics, and inform our training based on that. Inform our training based on the gait mechanics or the throwing mechanics or climbing mechanics that would have shown up in, you know, our evolutionary biomechanics. And how much of that do you think is important to focus on versus a general physical education?
The general physical education should be that. Let's do this with diet first and then come back to movement. You know, you can sell me a paleo diet. And I actually went keto last year for a few months to see how it would go. But you don't know what people were eating back then. We knew somewhat about what people were eating back then, but the fossil record is thin. And so, you know, I'm supposed to eat nothing but peanut butter and chicken or something because that's keto. That doesn't feel natural to me. I like so what is natural in terms of movement? Well, no native person is getting up and running 5 kilometers in the morning. I get up in the morning, I run 6 kilometers, I run 4 miles. And that's the stupidest thing to do from the point of view of an indigenous person I've ever heard of. And nobody does it. You know, we hear about these people who run for long distances in South America. Well, they don't get up and exercise in the morning. That's a total waste of calories. So how do we engineer this exercise thing for a whole bunch of people? I don't think it looks like we have them running barefoot over stones. That could be helpful as an exercise, but we're not going back to, unless the bomb goes off and we all have to deal with a very, very different Earth. We're not going to take a whole citified population and move them back onto the countryside and have them live in some paleo way. It's just not going to happen. It was the same in the 70s when we went to all that back to the land food stuff. And people were going across the railroad tracks to fill up their things of oil at the good neighborhood co-op. You know, I don't know if you had those things in Canada, but that was the way health food worked for a while. And now we have health food stores, and now we have a health food section in the regular grocery store. And it's going to be the same thing with movement. All of these really extreme paleo, Wim Hof, other things that are Ido Portal, the movement people are doing wonderful things. They're doing great things, but those aren't the solutions for society. Those are the solutions for an exploration into what we might do. But those are probably not the answers, just as the good neighbor co-op wasn't the answer to getting health food distributed throughout the whole population. The extremes that you're seeing now of paleo exercise or going back to the natural, well, we're not going to live in the natural, folks. We have to have an exercise program that is tailored to the urban person, unless you're contemplating a wholesale change of how society lives. And we think, I'm sorry, I'm going to stick a little thing on the end of that. And we think that 3 times a week of going to the gym or 2 times a week of going to yoga class or something like that is going to counterbalance the other 165 hours of sitting around and being on computers and looking at screens. And I'm not sure that equation has found its final settlement yet.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, go ahead.
So the way I've been doing it, from what I've gathered from this whole subsection niche of biomechanics, is to integrate movement into my day. So I'm a chiropractor. Instead of sitting down when I'm working on someone, I'm in size of position. I'm on my knees. I'm getting that what an indigenous person would do as they rest and as they work. I'm doing the same thing. So I'm putting that in my day. I'm making sure I get more sun. I'm going out for walks. I'm basically exercising, putting in exercise snacks 5 minutes a day. Would that be some sort of intervention that you would do yourself in terms of spatial medicine?
I absolutely do that. I live in Maine. I cannot. We live in Canada. You can't go around without shoes in my environment all the time. But I make sure that I change my shoes at least 4 times a day. So I just have a bunch of shoes outside my door, and I'm going to take a different one depending on what I'm about to do. Do I need boots? Do I need shoes? But I'm going to change a lot. I don't have one pair of shoes that I wear. In that way, I'm not adapting my feet to all the different things in the earth, but at least I'm adapting my feet to different shoes every day. And exactly the kinds of remedies or bits that you're talking about is to integrate movement into life, as opposed to I have this time, you know, Thursday afternoon at 5 o'clock when I go smash the shit out of a squash ball. But for the rest of the time, I'm sitting at a desk. But I really enjoy that. Katie Bowman is another person who's really done a lot of work in that realm of she's raising her children without furniture, and she puts the pots that she uses most on the top shelf so that she has to reach up and get them down. It's this, those kinds of opportunities for movement, I think, are really great. But it's a little bit like recycling your trash, you know, good for you, but it's not going to solve the social problem. And I'm all for that kind of thing, but I don't see how the social problem gets solved without going into the schools. And this is not new. We had 1963, and when I'm just first going to school or first going to high school, it was the President's Council on Physical Fitness of John Kennedy back in those days. It was recognized as a problem then, and it's a much worse problem now.
It really does seem like more of a societal structure issue in terms of the industrialization. You know, even myself, like I work anywhere between 6 to 10 hours a day on a computer, and I've worked to the best of my ability to mitigate some of that. I have a window that I can look up from my computer and kind of look at the mountains off in the background. My desk is a standing walking desk, so I'm walking about 12 miles a day as I work. And I do the best that I can to be in perpetual motion or kind of emulate, you know, what a normal quote unquote human being would do in a very unnatural environment, so to speak. You know, I try to emulate as much of the natural environment as I can, but it even feels that the emulation doesn't go far enough. Like the actual issue is that we, you know, our society is set up to encourage these unnatural inputs and these unnatural things that we adapt to. Even the food thing that you mentioned earlier, like I realized that most of my food is incredibly soft. Even if I'm eating meats, even if I'm eating, you know, chewing on some of the sinews and stuff, I like a lot of people are now chewing this, this mastic gum, you know, this hard tree sap, because it's like, it's the only thing that's going to work their masseters and encourage some of this forward growth of their jaw. And
I love how it's coming back, because the only people who used mastic gum when I was a kid was the old guys whose wives told them they couldn't smoke their pipes in the house anymore. They were chewing that. it's just funny how things go around and come around again and again. There's a thing in my world called the fascia blaster. It's a plastic thing that looks like something out of the top of your dishwasher. And it was around 20 years ago, and then it was for cellulite, and now it's for fascia. And, you know, 20 years from now, it'll be back again, and it'll be for your aura or something. But these things, it's just fun to watch. I've gotten old enough now, so I've just watched them come around several times. If you read, to answer your question of what is the natural thing? I think the real required reading for this is Daniel Lieberman's Exercised book, his new book called Exercised. And in it, just to go back, the people that he's looked at who are living agricultural Stone Age, as close as we would get to that kind of hunter-gatherer culture, they engage in mild exercise about 5 hours a day. The rest of the time, they're sitting around telling stories. But 5 hours a day, they have to go wash their clothes, build something, go hunting, go gathering, whatever it is. I like that. I like to see if I can get 5 hours a day in which I am engaged in mild exercise. And I don't know if that's the formula. And who knows whether it's the same for everybody. Anyway, we might find that ectomorphs need more and mesomorphs need middle and endomorphs really need less to support their physiology. So we're acting as if people were a monolith that we could prescribe exercise, but that's not the way it's going to work. We need to know what works when for whom. And a lot of the fitness industry is just designed around mesomorphs, are designed around those people who are governed physiologically by their musculoskeletal system, and they are the doers of this world, and it's easier to get them to do things. It's not as easy to get an ectomorph or an endomorph to do things, so you have to be strategic if you have ectomorphs and endomorphs in your practice. And unfortunately, what's happened with a lot of trainers is they work at gyms and ectomorphs and endomorphs never go there, so they only work with mesomorphs. So you have a great formula for mesomorphs, and then you try to take that out to the society, and you find, well, that's not actually going to work, because all of society is not people who should be in the gym and are not. There are a lot of them are people who just don't go to, are not going to thrive in gyms, and they need to be approached in a different way socially to get them to be included.
One of the approaches, sorry, Will, I'll let you go in a second here. I just wanted to take a note on that, because one of the approaches that I am noticing in some functional fitness circles is this approach to trying to adapt a person's frame and physiology to resemble a different phenotype. So if you do have like an ectomorph or an endomorph, to gradually rework their frame and their system and their level of integration to more resemble a mesomorph, and then build from that. And so it's almost like the foundation is like, you need to get them closer to this archetype. And it, you know, is it possible to actually change a person's archetype by working on their frame, by working on some of their psychophysiology? And
according to Sheldon, who did the work, no, it's not possible to change people at that level, but I'm not convinced of that. I think you might be able to change people, but I don't want to take all the ectomorphs and endomorphs out of the world and make them all mesomorphs. I really enjoy the feeling states that an endomorph produces, and I really like the drive and the zest for detail that an ectomorph has. So I don't want to turn everybody into a mesomorph. Sorry, can't go down that road with you.
No. And
let's go back to this thing. If you take a very simple, because you asked me this question first, if we take a very simple definition of the universe, space, time, matter, and energy. Yes, matter unfolds in space over time using energy. I know that's not very quantum or string theory sophisticated, but it's our basic universe. So there's a medicine for each of those irreducible things. There is a medicine of matter. Material medicine is the medicine that goes all the way back to Hippocrates and his four humors, but was really formalized about 400 or 500 years ago with William Harvey and circulation of blood. And we've been doing all kinds of things with the material world since then, mostly to do with the blood system. You know, that's the central system of material medicine, is getting things into the blood, getting things around the blood, learning things from the blood. So that medicine of matter is going everywhere in our body, but using the blood system a lot. And then you have, about 150 years ago, Sigmund Freud organized the medicine of time. I'm going to call it the medicine of time. Of course, I'm referring to psychiatry and psychotherapy and that whole idea of therapy, which, again, goes all the way back to the village elders and the village wise woman. People have been practicing psychology forever, but it was formalized 150 years ago in Vienna. And they've been going for 150 years. And why do I call it the medicine of time? Because a therapist is trying to get you into the present moment, not anxious about a future that hasn't happened yet or pulled back by a past that should be in the past. So I call that the medicine of time. You notice that the medicine of time has been pulled into the medicine of matter, and lots of psychiatrists are giving drugs now for ADHD and bipolar and the rest of it. So that kind of skill is less now, because people are just using drugs to get to the place that they want to go. All right. There's also an energetic medicine, which I'm not going to talk much about. I would put acupuncture or homeopathy or things in there that actually work directly with the energy system. And since I'm not very knowledgeable on that score, I will leave that. But that leaves, is there a medicine of space? And I believe that one, of course, the medicine of time focused on the nervous system, and the medicine of space focuses on the fascial system. And it's unfolding. And so if you think about the medicine of how we unfold into space, that's in material medicine, that's orthopedics, it's physical therapy, has been the little bit that we've had about spatial medicine in regular medicine. And not that orthopedics isn't a very advanced thing, but on the other hand, it's still kind of carpentry from the previous century, a lot of what orthopedics is. If we look into the future, we're going to see that spatial medicine is going to be applied by electroceuticals or some kind of electrical management, maybe of the embryo, to where we don't have these so-called genetic anomalies, which appear to be something else. That's a subject of how we are shaped. But in looking into this thing of how we're shaped, I have studied embryology and hydraulics and engineering and anthropology and a lot of things. Not that I'm an expert in any of these things, but it led me to study these to understand, how do we live in a body? How do we shape our body? How do we become competent in the environment? How do we move ourselves through the environment? And that's what all the folks in spatial medicine now are addressing themselves to. And I only call it spatial medicine because people are talking crap about each other. You talk to the physiotherapists and they have no time for the yoga teachers, and those have no time for the chiropractors, and the chiropractors have no time for the osteopaths, and on and on it goes around the circles of everybody talking crap about poor Naudi Aguilar, who's just trying to do something in functional patterns, and he's a scrappy little kid. So, you know, he gets into these controversies. It's all of these things. I really want to stop that. We should stop talking crap about each other, because every one of these things works for somebody sometime, or they wouldn't survive in the marketplace. Yes, there are stupid things and they don't survive very long in the marketplace. But anything that has survived in the marketplace is serving somebody in some way. So I don't like lying there and having my head slightly adjusted and be told to bring my head forward and up like the Alexander technique. That's not my way of doing things. I don't want to get in there and do something. So I like roughing. I like the fact that somebody grabs my body, or I get to grab somebody else's body and play in that arena. And that very, very delicate Feldenkrais-y type stuff, I've studied it. I know it. I understand it. Doesn't work for me well, but it does work for other people really well. So if I try to impose my, oh no, we should be doing the Rolfing thing, you know, we should be doing this by tissue work, that's just not going to work for the people who are very, very sensitive and for whom that just feels like total invasion, and please don't do that to me ever again. And so if I'm going to be a successful practitioner, I have to have a variety of arrows in my quiver. And it would be the same thing for if we were doing movement training, if we were setting up a societal movement training, I would set it up for adaptability. You can specialize. You can specialize after you're 18. You can specialize sometime down in your life that you want to do. You could probably specialize before that. But we would want to make sure that you had general KQ, that you had general kinesthetic intelligence, that you could solve the problems in your body, that you could recognize things going on. That hunches, I think that's a really important thing, that intuition is one of the things that comes more into play the more the system is organized. And then when the system is random and not organized, the ability of that person to act as an antenna for what's around them, whatever you think that stuff is, but people really are either attuned or unattuned, and I think spatial medicine has a lot to do with that kind of attunement.
Since you brought up Naudi, he actually requested that we ask you something that has been kind of, he's been very curious about, is very excited that we were talking to you.
Last time he was on the phone with me, he cursed me out. So if he has a question, I will look on it with circumspection and see whether I want to answer it. I don't care whether he cursed me out. I like Naudi and I like the effect that he's had on the thing. Do I agree with everything he does? No, of course not. I don't agree with everything everybody. I don't agree with all the things I do, but but I think it's been a good force in the world, or whatever you want to say. Anyway, what was Naudi's question?
Well, he was curious about your take on the relevancy of the piezoelectric effect. There's this idea that if you have a well-integrated fascial system, that when you take a step, there's a transfer of energy from your foot all the way to your cranium, and that particular transfer of force creates a piezoelectric effect that generates energy within the system. And he was wondering if you thought that was relevant, or if it was worth looking into, or if you had any other further thoughts on that.
It's absolutely worth looking into, and I agree with everything you say up till you say generates energy in the system. So I don't know what that means, but absolutely, every time you step, there are several forces going up through your body. First is the ground reaction force goes up, and that goes through your body at the speed of sound in water, whatever that is, 520 miles an hour, 750 clicks per hour. I don't know, somewhere in there, but about 2.5 to 3 times faster than the nervous system. So your fascial system communicates mechanical information at, as I say, about 2.5 times the nervous system. Of course, the nervous system has all different speeds for showing things, but it's not at the speed of light. It's very slow comparatively, and it's slower than the biomechanical forces that go through the body. So, for instance, your knee-jerk reflex when somebody pounds your patella, that's very slow. That already went through your fascial system before it even got to, before the signal from your patellar tendon even got to your spinal cord. Now, what's the significance of that going through? Does it create a piezoelectric charge? Yeah, it does. Does that open ion channels in the cells and make a particular difference? I don't know. We've just discovered the piezo-1 and piezo-2 actual molecular receptors on membranes that detect pressure. So these are presumably what's being used in the muscle spindles, Golgi tendon organs, et cetera, to actually get this done. And we know that some people have more piezo-2 than others. So I'm right there with, yep, these forces are going through the body, and yep, every cell is listening to them. I'm getting stuck on that, and that generates energy. What kind of energy is that generating?
So can I clean up that question a little bit? Sure. Instead of generating energy, could I say store and release energy? And okay, if your fascia is healthy, you would have more viscoelasticity, more water between the layers, and that would increase the effect?
Yes. But as usual, I'm going to say it depends, right? Okay. Because if you have too much water in your tissues, they get soggy. So at age 55, I was a couch potato. Very good body worker, by the way, but a couch potato. And I was writing books instead of doing anything outside. I said, I'll exercise when I'm dead. And then at 55, that became not viable. And at the same time, I read from Robert Schleip the research on building elasticity in the body that had started with kangaroos and then went to human tendons. And, you know, it's all this thing about storing elastic energy in the Achilles tendon and plantar fascia, et cetera, that gets given back to you when you're in gait. And that was a very convincing argument to me. Elasticity is elasticity is an attribute of youth. I want to stay young. Ergo, I'm going to make myself elastic. And that has been such a successful thing for me. I feel great. I'm in my mid-70s. I feel like most people around me in their 50s. And that's not because I eat very well, because I don't. And it's not because I exercise a lot, because I don't. But I really have enjoyed keeping myself bouncy. So every time you step, you store energy in the elasticity of the fascia, which exists at several levels of scale. It's contributed to by several levels of scale. And if you don't use it elastically, you don't retain that elasticity. It becomes more viscous. It becomes more like silly putty and less elastic. And more like a Tempur-Pedic bed, and you know, you push on it and it comes back slowly. So I'm quite sure that there was water that had seeped into my tendons. I started bouncing. Every time you're bouncing on it, you're stretching the tendon, wank, 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 as I run. And that gradually squeezed the water out of the tendon and made more water around the tendon, which means that it's in that lubricating area that we now know is not a strict bursa or tendinosynovial sheath, but is an area of lubrication between the paratendon and the tendon, and that's working better. Yeah. So I'm not sure if two things are being confused here. You definitely are listening. Your whole body, every cell in your body is listening to its mechanical and environment through these piezo receptors. And so energy can be stored and released there, and you certainly get the energy of knowing where your body is. But it's the storage and release part is, again, you're not generating energy. You are storing and releasing almost as much as you stored. It's very efficient, but not maximally efficient, or we'd have a perpetual motion machine. And again, I'm stuck on the word generate.
Yeah, I think it's maybe just a phrasing issue. But that's mm-hmm. that's more or less, I think, the nature of the question that we were kind of looking for. In terms of what you're talking about, the importance of elasticity in your fascial system being related to youth, one of the criticisms that some of the functional fitness space has about practices like yoga or things that focus a lot on stretching, static stretching, is this idea that you can create flaccidity in tendons and connective tissue, and doing excessive stretching can actually decrease qualities of elasticity over time, decrease your tensegral qualities of your entire body. And this is one where, you know, maybe people in functional patterns, for example, go after yoga a lot because of this. And they use this word flaccidity. One of our audience questions was, do you think that there's any validity to this criticism of yoga? And if so, what do we do about it?
I don't know, rail against it. Now let's just say we're talking traditional yoga here, and holding the kind that I did in the 70s of from my Iyengar, holding the poses for a very long time. Since then, yoga has, in America anyway, has branched out to all the different kinds of much more athletic Ashtanga type of yoga, vinyasa flow type of yoga, restorative type of yoga. But if we are talking about people who are doing a lot of stretching and not much else, yes, I would say it doesn't necessarily lead to flaccidity of muscles. Do plank for 3 minutes, call it chaturanga, and it becomes yoga. That doesn't require no strength. So yoga people are not necessarily going flaccid with overstretching, but I think there is an argument for tensegrity, if your audience knows what we mean by tensegrity, that mm-hmm. what we're looking for around the body is even tone throughout the body. What I'm looking for when I get somebody in front of me is, where are the areas of high tone, super high tone, and where are the corresponding areas of low tone? Because I would like to make that palatonic or equal tonus around the whole body. Now, there's some differences between the muscles that are very close to the bones and the muscles that are more out on the surface. But generally speaking, you're looking for that evenness of tone. So when I get somebody who's really loose, who's done a whole lot of stretching, they're loose everywhere. But if you comb through, I have to go through their body with my fingers, you'll find isolated places in the hamstrings that are just an island of tension in the middle of I wouldn't call it flaccidity, but looseness. And those are the ones that you need to actually find with those people and get them out of there. It's just not the same job with everybody. Everybody's different.
It sounds a lot like there's this awareness that individual treatment is very, very important, right? The awareness of the individual over adhering to necessarily universal prescriptions and universal principles. In your estimation, though, even with the sensitivity to, you know, different things working for different people, do you think that there are universal principles that are, you could say, are most important for fascial health or most important for health and movement in general that could be applied to broad spectrums or broad populations?
Okay. Yes, and it's early days of finding those out. And we just did one, and that's elasticity. And, if you're doing cyclic movement of about a second, jumping rope, running, walking briskly, and any things where you're going up in the air and coming down or bouncing off a wall or interacting with a heavy ball, any of those things are going to build elasticity in the body, and strict hatha, hold the position, go slowly and listen to piano music yoga, will not do that. It just simply, that's not included. But, this is just kind of getting back at the yoga people, because the yoga people have been telling the sports people for years they weren't doing any stretching and the sports people weren't looking. And then the sports people started doing, and then they started doing stretching to build to warm themselves up. So I think turnabout is fair play here. The sports people have already learned a lot from yoga, so if they have something to teach them back, I think that's a good thing. But you don't need to go after yoga to do this. It's not that yoga is bad. It's that yoga was developed for the Brahmins of the late 16, early 1700s, and the needs of 21st century Americans are not the same as people who were studying sutras for hours a day and could recite them by memory. Most people I know can't even remember their own phone number. We need a yoga that is developing the minds that we're going to need for the 21st century. And we better develop them quick, because the 21st century is coming down upon us.
So I wanted to talk about tensegrity versus continuous compression. Yes. So in the niche that we're in, we talk a lot about fascia, a lot about tensegrity, but we inevitably get up against, I would say, science-based researchers, I guess you can say, who are like, no, continuous compression, tensegrity may not even be a thing. And it blows my mind that that's the case, right? And it's still not widely accepted that tensegrity is visible in the body. So my question there is, do you believe it's proven without a doubt that the body is a continuous compression tension structure? And is that the model that should be presented going forward?
Okay. That's a great question. How much time do we have?
As much as you want.
Go for it. Yeah.
So Einstein did not negate Newton's laws. Force equals MV, and for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The laws of thermodynamics did not get blown up by Einstein. He just showed that they were special cases that work in particular times, but that generally there was this general theory of relativity that was much more general and applied to things that were very large and very small, not just the apples falling from a tree that we can see in our daily life. So the laws of biomechanics, which was Newton applied, published by Borelli in 1687. All right, it's 1687. We've been working with single muscles and levers. It's now 2022. Do we need an update? Yes, we do need an update to our thinking about the engineering of the body. We thought we had solved the problem of engineering of the body when we said, essentially, movement takes place through the limitations of joint shape, the ligaments on the joint and the muscles that are moving it. And so we thought about the musculoskeletal system, and it just left out that system that surrounds, coordinates, and provides the physiological limbic for all of this stuff to happen, and that's the fascial system. It's not that we didn't think about fascia. We thought about fascia and ligaments and tendons and iliotibial tract and things like that, but that's not the system. We're now seeing it, what's going on with the fascial system? Okay, now, if you look at that in terms of a continuous compression model, that's how we've looked at it for these last millennia, is that the foot is a tetrahedron somehow, because that doesn't work out very well with continuous compression, but then the tibia sits on top of the talus, and the femur sits on top of the tibia, and the hip bone sits on top of that, and stop trying to gaslight me. Obviously, we're a continual compression structure from top to bottom. And that lends itself to the idea of, the skeleton is a stable structure, and therefore each individual muscle moves the skeleton. And all I have to do is take every other muscle off the skeleton and say, what would that muscle do if I left its attachments to its endpoints? And that's how we have defined a muscle that's working. Now, if we turn ourselves to tensegrity, the tensegrity geometry developed by Buckminster Fuller in the 40s is the way, and I'm saying this, but I'm no mathematician or physicist, is the way that the universe is constructed. So everything on a molecular or atomic level is a tensegrity. And I feel pretty comfortable saying that because I can sit in the comfort of my ignorance. I don't know. But molecules, atoms, and macromolecules seem to be constructed on tensegral principles. And then if we go up one level of scale of magnitude, if we get to cells, the establishment of the cytoskeleton, the actin fibers and the microtubules that are inside the cells, acting like muscles and bones, but changeable ones. The muscles change, the microtubules dissolve and come out. That's how a white blood cell can dissolve its cytoskeleton, become an octopus, swim between the cells of a capillary and extravasate itself in that way, and then reassemble its skeleton outside to go do battle with whatever bacteria is out there or infection is out there. So we've seen tensegrity act within each cell. And now we know, and this has just been established in the last few years, that it's an absolute direct connection from the DNA in this cell out to the membrane, across that intercellular space, connecting up to the next membrane, all the way down to the DNA of the next cell. So in other words, if the cell next to you is in an unhappy mechanical place, maybe that gets contributed to you. Maybe that contributes to your feeling of well-being as a cell in the body. All of these things are just coming up now and just coming up for study. Donald Ingber has done so much of this work on what I'm talking about, which is called mechanotransduction from cell to cell. And that means that every cell has its happy place. And if you're collapsed over it, in terms of spatial medicine, you're crowding up those cells and requiring them to work under less space. Now, our cells are very adaptable, and we can adopt the most god-awful postures and still function. You know, I don't know if you've seen people with really severe scoliosis. Their organs still function, and you wonder how, because the shape of the ventral cavity inside would not seem to support the functioning of those organs. But cells are very adaptable, and people can adapt to these strange postures and strange movement practices that that people do. But where were we starting from this? I just got lost.
where I was going with that is so what I get is obviously the let's say the bicep attaches to the bone and it attaches to, you know, up here, and I can see it's going into a lever system. Why are you complicating things? It's obviously a lever system, bro. That's what I get all the time. And I'm like, you know, they call us kind of like the fascia boys. You're always talking about fascia. You're putting too much importance on it. It is obviously a lever system. What do you say to that?
Well, that's where I started, and thank you for putting me back on track. Einstein did not negate Newton. He simply included Newton in a larger thing. Tensegrity does not negate leverage biology. I'm not saying there are no levers in the body. And in this, I have arguments with the hardcore tensegrity people who just say everything is a tensegrity and you have to take it on faith. Well, I'm having a hard time taking that on faith when I watch somebody do a broad jump and land with both feet, some meters later. It's pretty much looks to me like the foot's going, the talus is going into the tibia, and the tibia is going into the femur and using the menisci. But it's pretty much a continuous compression model. So I prefer to say that tensegrity is a model that we could look at. It really works well in the spine and the rib cage. It does not work well at the elbow and the knee. The leverage model works better at the elbow and the knee. I'm going to have a hard time. It's just a question of which model is most easily explanatory. If you talk about the knee, then I'm saying tensegrity is way too complicated, bro. It's the leverage model. But if you're talking to me about the spine, I'm saying I see people get longer without losing their spinal curves. How do they get longer without losing their spinal curves? Because when you relax the muscles along the back, the ligaments of the spine, it's not the muscles of the spine that form the tensegrity, it's the ligaments. The muscles do what they do, but that's not the tensegrity part. And the ligaments, if the muscles are in balance and relaxed, let go on the facet joints. The discs get less chubby and the facets slide on each other a little bit and the whole body gets a little bit taller. That's not explainable by the leverage model. That's a tensegrity model. I don't think the movement of the rib cage, sure, you could do it with a leverage model, but your calculations would be have you into the middle of next week before you even thought about what the client should do next. A tensegrity model tells me right away, oh my God, when this person moves side to side in whatever side to side motion, you know, coronal movement that they're doing, ribs 5 through 9 just don't go along for the ride. You know, they don't differentiate relative to each other. And that's a tensegrity thing. And I can see that in a second. And don't have to do a great big analysis of it. I guess it's a question of just what model is most useful at the time. And I would say that my own feeling is that the body is not strictly a tensegrity structure, but a tension-dependent structure. Sometimes it's acting as a tensegrity, sometimes it's acting as a leverage model, and most of the time it's acting like a sailboat, where the mast is more or less rigid in the middle of the skeleton, and the muscles and fascia are like guy wires around that, which is why I got so interested in the longitudinal ones of the anatomy trains, because of all the animals on the planet, we have the smallest base of support for the highest center of gravity. So therefore, the balance of the guy wires is very, very important around our skeleton.
Anthony?
Well, does that answer your question?
We can go on and on about this, but yeah, it definitely... Definitely.
Yeah. So I would say when people come at this, I would say, yeah, it's the leverage model is the best way to explain the knee and the elbow. It is a terrible way to explain a shoulder.
So, what I was, what I wanted to add on top of that is the models drive kind of where we go in reality. So if it's very much a leverage model, you'll see exercises come out of that leverage model that makes sense. Okay. And that's where we're at right now, in my opinion, right? If you have the tensegrity in the back of your mind as the primary model, then you get more gyroscopic movements, more fluidity, and able to take it more into a three-dimensional space, the actual movements, if that makes sense. So that's kind of what I wanted to get at there, was that the models drive reality, and I wanted to hear from you what you thought about the tensegrity, and I think you've answered the question. So.
Well, the only thing I would add on top of what you said is what I'm looking for, the practicality of the tensegrity model in training and rehab is everything gives a little, nothing gives too much. So that if something is held rigid in the body and you put it through a functional movement that requires movement through that part, something else has to make up for the lack of movement in that part. In other words, if your lumbars are sprained into a hyperextension, then when you do a forward bend, you're going to get it all out of your thoracic spine because your lumbar spine isn't going to do it. So it's that everything gives a little, nothing gives too much, and nothing stays absolutely still. You're a chiropractor. If God wanted a bone between the sacrum and the ischial tuberosity, she would have put one there. But in point of fact, she put a ligament there. So that tells you there has to be a little springiness in that ligament when we're walking, when we're squatting, when we're, you know, putting a lot of force up through that back line and through that very delicate arrangement between the sacrum and the hip bones that was designed for something else entirely and now has to serve us to hold up the spine. That kind of thing, I think, is best read in a kind of tensegrity way and not a mechanical thing. You named off the, just to go back to what you did, you named off the attachments of the biceps, but I would say the biceps are also attached to the pectoralis minor. They're also attached to the coracobrachialis. They're also attached to the coracobrachialis and brachialis underneath. The supinator, that through the septum, it's actually connected to the triceps, that there are so many attachments that we take away to only do the proximal and distal attachments. And that becomes a really important thing when you're talking about explosive power out of the quads, that if you don't have glide between the rectus femoris and the vastus intermedius underneath, you are going to be limited in the amount of explosive power you can push out of those, knee extension you can push out of those quads. And so I think when they say you fascia guys, I will say that I'm guilty to the point that I tried to make everything about fascia for a while. And does it have to do with this? And does it have to do with that? And probably the answer to some of those questions is no. But there are answers like the one I just gave, which is, the answer is really yes, that if you don't have glide between within a muscle group and even within the muscle, but certainly between muscle groups, you just can't get the full performance out of that person.
Go ahead.
Okay.
We're both about to say.
Yeah. Go ahead, Anthony.
You know, this idea of, training specificity as it pertains to, you know, like pulling these exercises based on a lever system or a fascia system, taking into account how many insertion points a muscle has when it comes to training. You know, when you're doing a bicep curl, it's very isolated, right? And again, within the functional fitness area, like niche, they'll talk a lot about how isolation training is detrimental because you're creating these adaptations to your system. You're maybe disintegrating your fascial system by biasing muscle groups too much. And, you know, if you're focused on these mechanical movements, these frontal and sagittal plane movements that move very linearly, you become disintegrated in your system to a degree. I was curious about your perspective on that. And I was curious on, are there ways of training that negatively impact your fascial system in terms of its integration? And should that be a major consideration when you are designing a training program for yourself?
Well, we just talked about one of them. If your only training is stretchy yoga, stretch is not the answer to everything. And stretching excessively will not build you into shape. As we also said, yoga contains a lot of strengthening, and different kinds of yoga contain different things there. So I'm not, I don't want to set up a straw man and knock them down. But when we're designing programs for people, what was the question? Whether we, what's the basics?
You could basically say, the question is, does training muscle groups in isolation and biasing muscle groups in mechanical ways negatively impact the integration of your fascial system? Is it something we should be concerned about?
No, as long as it's going into integrated motion at the end, I think you can, the whole Nautilus idea, which is where I go, I'm probably way out of date with this, but that was developed for rehab of muscles to get an isokinetic contraction out of the muscle, and then it got just universalized to everybody. And you don't lift things with a Nautilus cam on them, so you don't get that strength here if you're lifting a weight. So if you're training on a Nautilus system, what are you doing? You're putting a whole bunch of biases in your system that will not operate when you go back into the real world and actually pick up a piece of iron. Obviously the best way to train for something is to do that thing. However, when we're talking about getting people to get back on isolated thing, I've gotten great value about getting on a quad machine and doing my leg curl and my hamstring curls and things like that. But they are linear exercises. And if I did them, I was doing them under a program where the guy was being very careful to keep me under my under my demand to make sure that we were going all around the body to build groups successively, but in a generally integrated way. And I thought that was a very successful thing. And there were areas of my body that my regular training didn't get to that his precision training really did. So I'm not trying to take away training at all, but if you start with those kinds of isolated movements to make sure you have that skill, but then it's got to come into a helical movement to be most sport movements, most functional movements are helical, not linear. Even running, running is helical.
Right. And I think that's one of the major criticisms of this linear training is that if you specialize in it or overly specialize to it, or even just even adapt to it over time, because you've been programming it for years, that those helical movements suffer because you're not only creating structural changes that are biasing yourself towards linear movement, but your nervous system inputs are being biased towards linear movements. So when you're, for example, let's use the quad machine as an example, right? That knee extension as an example. It's a high nervous system input because you're handling a heavy amount of weight. And then when your body is in and this isn't necessarily my argument, this is just arguments that I've heard. When your body is in a situation where it needs to handle forces or respond or be reactive or reflexive, it's going, because you've conditioned it with these nervous system inputs, it's going to revert back to the thing that you have programmed into it the most, which is these lifting or these linear movements, and you don't necessarily have a reflexive helical approach to handling external stressors at that point.
No, this is the Michel Dalcour argument of the kids from the farms were beating those who'd been on a wrestling team for 4 years. How was that happening? And then he realized that a lot of the farm movements were more functional than what wrestlers were actually being trained on. But again, I just because yoga doesn't have a bounce in it is no reason to crap all over yoga. There's all kinds of usefulness that's going on there. And just because if you get stuck on linear movements, that will lead to a bad outcome does not mean that linear movements are bad. They're great for getting started and making sure that you're including the muscles. Every time I go back for training, explain this to me, Anthony. Are you William or Bill? I'm sorry.
Do you prefer? Yeah.
Will.
Yeah.
Tell me why. I am a pretty active person. I run. I sail my boat, etc. I try to. I'm fairly aware of my body because of my work. And yet, every time I go back to the gym to train, my vastus medialis is weak compared to my vastus lateralis. What happened to my training? What happened to my use of my body in those months? Because I don't go to the gym very often, but when I go, I will put myself on that quad machine to test out my, and always the vastus medialis is sore afterwards, which means I wasn't using it properly, or fully anyway, in my regular movement. Why is that going about? I'm 75. I'm still trying to figure that one out. And you get it if you get on a friggin' quad machine. And I hate quad machines because when do you sit down and use your quads in full extension? Unless you have a grandchild on your ankle that you are riding up and down on your ankle, you would never do that. And the reason you would never do that is when you use your quads like crazy, when you're kicking something or really squatting up, you need stability in the opposite SI joint, which means that the deep lateral rotators, particularly the piriformis, have to fire at the moment that the quads go off. If you're sitting in a chair, they don't fire. So you are training. This is an example of what I'm saying. Linear training does not result in good results. Is you're predisposing yourself, and I've had so many of them in my practice, you're predisposing yourself to sacroiliac joints on the opposite side by training your quads without training the neural coordination of the deep lateral rotators on the opposite side. So linear training has dangers in it, but that doesn't mean that getting on the quad machine is bad if you then get up and kick the ball for a while, because then you've taken it into coordination. So it's a question of not dissing the folks who are doing that, but informing them that, yes, this is great what you're doing, and then they have to get up and integrate this or you're going to have a bad outcome.
Yeah, that's fair. I wanted to ask you about dissection in terms of the anatomy trains, let's say the lines of tension. And, yep. 2012 is when I believe it was 2012, I came upon your book. I took cadaver classes. I never heard of fascia in terms of, something that mm-hmm. can be manipulated or worked out or anything like that. We cut through it because that's what we were instructed to do. Now, sure. You like looking at your work, I'm like, whoa, what is this? There's no way you can just continuously cut the fascia in one unit from head to toe, let's say the front line or whatever. The critics would say, you're just cutting it that way. It could be cut anyway. Or alternatively, they would say, since fascia is everywhere, whatever you do trains the fascia. How would you respond to, let's say the first question is really the question. Can you continuously cut the lines of tension?
Whatever you do trains the fascia, but that's not, I'm answering the second question first. Whatever you sure. do trains the fascia, but it doesn't train the whole system necessarily. Whatever you do trains the muscles, but it doesn't train all the muscles equally. So... No. That's kind of a silly argument to me that I want to pay attention to all the systems that are going to help my body get done what I want to get done. I'm not into sports, but I'm into intelligence. And intelligence is the ability to get to your goals by a variety of means. And so I want my body to be adaptable to that variety of means. Okay. So the first question again.
When you dissect cadavers, do you actually see the full connection between the lines of tension, let's say front line, deep line, any of the lines?
Yes. If you go to our website, I'd be happy to show you the dissections of those absolute continuities from top to bottom. So I could, with a little... knife of some kind, I could start right up here in the head and I could just go, larger and larger spirals. And I could, like you do with an orange or an apple like that, I could peel the fascia off the body and it would be in one long strip that went like this. That's not meaningful. Yes, you can cut up the fascia anyway if you want to, but is it meaningful or not? So in the anatomy trains, we have disciplines, and the discipline is you have to stay at the same level and it has to go in the same direction. Those are the basic two rules. If you follow those rules, I believe you'll come up with a system much like mine, because I'm not the only one who's come up with it for one thing, and two, I've dissected them all out. And there are places where I've had to change my theory. For instance, the superficial front line, it comes up with the rectus abdominis and then up the sternal fascia to get to the sternocleidomastoid and going to the asterion. It goes to the mastoid process, but the fascia goes right on up here to where the temporal, parietal, and occipital meet. So that's going from the top of your toes all the way up to where the tentorium attaches from the inside. And so I said, oh, well, there's this fascia. First, I had the sternalis muscle as part of that. And then as I got in there and did dissection, because I published the book, and then people said things like what you're saying, oh, this is just all in your imagination, Tom, or you're just carving it up the way you want to. And so I went in to find it. Now, the theory would say there is an actual fascial connection between the rectus abdominis and the sternocleidomastoid, which are about equally wide here. If you take the clital head of the sternocleidomastoid, you're about that wide, and the rectus abdominis is about that wide. So my theory, my beautiful theory, please don't destroy my theory, had a fascial thing that would come up here so that this whole fascia could move independent of the bones underneath it. I've had to change that. I think it's changed in the fourth edition. It's definitely going to be changed in the fifth edition. It's essentially a mechanical connection from the fifth rib where the rectus abdominis stops up here, and the rib cage will have to move if there's a shortening of the superficial front line. That is not good for my theory, but it is the truth. So I'd rather have the book reflect the truth than my wonderful theories. So we've had to modify them, but I don't think it's fair to say you could carve the body anyway. It is fair to say that fascia is omnidirectional. And I had this guy from Dubai or something telling me, yes, the fascia goes in all directions, so your lines are totally imaginary. And I said, okay, you could drive your car out of your garage and you could drive it in any direction. I think after 4 or 5 days, you'll discover these things called roads. And it's easier to drive your car on, and don't leave it up to its axles in mud. So I think the same thing about the anatomy train is the human body comes out, it does flexion, it does extension, it does rotation and lateral, and therefore builds up these roads, so to speak, that are easier to travel. And then we have our own roads, you know, people who are sitting with the head forward, they've got to have the back line has to be tighter to keep their head on. People who shove the hips forward have to have deep lateral rotators that are tight and hamstrings that have rolled up onto the adductors and stuck there. You know, you can make some predictions about the way things are going because the muscles have, well, I'm essentially stringing the muscles together like strings of sausages. And there are certainly times when muscles work absolutely individually. The biceps curl is a good example. It's not obviously just the biceps muscle acting on its own, but you can really isolate the muscles that we were talking about earlier that are around these hinge joints because they are around the hinge joint. It's awfully harder to isolate what muscle is being used around the shoulder. We were doing this thing with Eric Cressy a little while ago, who's the guy for the Yankees, the rehab guy for the Yankees. And so we were talking a lot about shoulder injuries. And of course, that's a fairly unnatural way to use the shoulder to try to put a 94-mile-an-hour fastball across the plate. So they get particular problems with that. But one of the things is substitutions that every pitcher in the world is overtraining the lats, and that ends up pulling the rib cage. This is what they're finding, ends up pulling the rib cage down in, and that a lot of the arm injuries that they were getting were actually from brachial plexus interference from the compression in the spine. And they should do this or they should do that. Just stop over-strengthening the lats. Stop compressing your spine. And a lot of these things that would be, what do you call this? Brachial plexus syndrome kind of things would just go away.
Interesting. Anthony, anything to add to that?
No. I'm taking all that in because it's, you know, this is the stuff that I geek out on, and whenever I hear about how everything's connected there and what's pulling on what, my brain goes in a million different directions. So, just taking that in for a second.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is the kind of thing that's been leveled as a criticism of the anatomy trains, which is fine. As I say, I think it's a very transitional thing between leverage anatomy and tensegrity, whatever tensegrity comes to be, but more tension-dependent models of the body. So we'll find that the role of fascia in this, I mean, obviously fascia is new. You've been training people's fascia since you started doing this. It's not that fascia is new. It's just thinking about fascia as a system is new. And our way of thinking about musculoskeletal action is very stubbornly plugged into our brains, and it's going to take a while for it to come out of that. And I don't think anatomy trains is by any means the final word in that. But I also don't think it's just an act of my imagination. I think there's something real going on in there.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that your work really brought me into this whole world because, like you were saying at the start, we need variety, right? Your work, Anatomy Trains, even the very beginning, I think I looked at the first edition, that got me thinking in a completely different direction. And, you know, I'd like to thank you for that, first of all. And and I think speaking to variety, it is good to have, even if your models aren't completely correct, to have variety so people have stepping stones to go to increase their way of looking at things. So, yeah, I just wanted to add that.
Yeah. So if we could do it, we'd have a bit of bounce, a bit of stretch, a bit of load, and a lot of awareness. I'm going back to your very first question. What would be the program? Make sure that every child is exposed to that. And when I went to school, I get a little bit of this is, you know, coming out of personal history. When I went to school, if you weren't good at sports, you got no attention at all. If you were good at sports, you got some attention. But if you were not good, you got no coaching whatsoever, no attention. In fact, lots of negative attention. And that put me from the age of 8 off sports, and I've never gotten back to it. I still don't like sports, but I do like movement. And I like movement a lot. I just the competitive part of it is distasteful to me. But I know it isn't for everybody else. That's great. I'm not trying to engineer it for anybody else. But this whole thing of how is the society going to move in this time of meta to get, because I'm going to have to stop here in a minute. I didn't realize how late we got, and I've been having so much fun talking to you. But I have another meeting. But the social cost of social media has been, you know, up there with the social dilemma and this whole discussion of AI and all of that kind of thing. But the opportunity, it seems to me, is that we get to come in and redesign physical education, which was definitely designed to prepare people for an industrial world. Do these industrial type of movements and you'll get your machine of your body up into the ring. That's another thing that really annoys me is the metaphor is lots of biomechanists have the metaphor of the body as a machine. The body can be thought of as a machine, but it's, again, a terrible metaphor. It doesn't take you very far. The body is much more like a plant than it is like a machine, but we continue to think of it like a machine. And so I think training in the future will be very different. I think training in the future is really going to have to expand its scope in terms of the number of people that it can serve. And then I think it needs to get into the schools by hook or by crook in such a way that our kids come out adaptably in the age of meta, because in 10 years, have you been to some of these VR things? Yes. I went to a VR thing in Singapore just before COVID. And, you know, I know I'm in a black room. I know there's no posts in it because we were there. Then you put on this helmet, and all of a sudden you're in a spaceship killing robots. And at some point I had to cross this bridge, and the bridge was moving a little bit, and there was a Lord of the Rings abyss on either side of the thing. I know I'm standing in a room. I know that the room has no trapdoors in it or anything. I know I've got a stupid helmet on. And I walked across that bridge with my anus puckered and my whole self lifted up because I was afraid of falling off. I think we have great opportunities with what's going on for physical education, even in these realms of fear and stuff like that, that are not the obvious things of building a muscle or stabilizing a joint. But in terms of building people, building competent people. So I think VR and other things offer a great opportunity, but we have to take that opportunity or people are just going to disappear up the metaverse. And I fear for human beings if we lose that part of our humanity.
I think a culture of embodiment is something that we are really trying to promote on this podcast. So I really, really appreciate you taking the time to have this discussion with us, to exploring some of the nuances of this topic, because it's a big problem. It's a big, big topic. And we were also having a lot of fun in this discussion. I feel like nearly an hour and a half went by in a blink, and I really wish we had more time. But Tom, thank you so much for everything that you've done for us personally in terms of how you've expanded our minds, for taking the time to share your perspectives with our audience. If there was something that you wanted our audience to learn from you or an exposure to your work, what would be the best place for them to find that?
Anatomytrains.com is the best place to find that. And we have got lots of freebie stuff up there. And then we can take your money if you want to sign up for courses with us, either online or in person. I want to thank you for this opportunity and thank you for what you're doing. I really appreciate the eclecticism and wide open range with what you're doing. Thank you for inviting me to your 100th episode. I feel very honored.
Well, we're very honored to have you. Imagine another person for episode number 100. It's a full circle sort of thing. You've been the most referenced person on our podcast in terms of your work with our other guests and with us. And again, it's an absolute honor. So guys, thank you so much for listening to episode 100 of the Art of Move podcast with myself, Anthony Manuel, Dr. William Raybar, and the one and only Tom Myers. If you like this episode, if you're listening on YouTube, please like, comment, subscribe. Let us know what you thought. Let us know what questions you have that you want us to discuss on future episodes. If you're listening on Spotify, leaving us a review always helps. You can find me on Instagram at Anthony.Manuel, M-A-N-U-E-L-E. Dr. Will is at The Art of Move. And Anatomy Trains Official is the Instagram page. But go to the website, www.anatomytrains.com, to go check out the work, the courses, the freebies, all the good stuff. And once again, Tom, thank you so much. This was just an absolute blast.
So thank you so much, Anthony and Will. See you down the road.
All right. Take care, guys.
Have a good one.